So I work on Rikers Island, and I'll be presenting some information that we have worked on over the last year about an overdose prevention training program. This work I was very involved in, but was really a team approach and involved colleagues at the Department of Health, as well as a large group from our Transitional Healthcare Coordination Team, which is part of Correctional Health Services. I have no financial conflicts of interest to disclose, though intranasal naloxone is currently in off-label use. So I think, has anyone been to any of the incarceration talks so far? Okay, good. Fresh room. So I'll actually tell you the details of Rikers Island, I guess. Though I know a couple people in the room have heard this before. So, you know, the common conception about mass incarceration in the U.S., we're the leading incarcerating country in the world. We have more people incarcerated in our country than any other place. And the general acceptance is that this has been driven over the years very much by deinstitutionalization of mental health hospitals starting around the 60s and 70s, but also the war on drugs, which led to incarceration of many low-level offenders who have drug possession or drug addiction problems. And over time, this obviously has grown and has become sort of its own industry in a way, right? So we also have lots of for-profit companies that now have an interest in mass incarceration. Opioid replacement therapy is rare in jails. New York City has had a methadone maintenance program since 1987, but it's one of the few medication-assisted treatment programs in the country. There is an overdose risk in jail. We know that it does cause deaths in many jail systems. And the process of jail interrupts treatment programs in the community. It interrupts social bonds that may help people adhere to their treatment programs. One distinction I should make right now, of course, is that between jail and prison. Jail is generally for detainees who are on trial, so they haven't been convicted yet of an offense. They're also local, generally, so they can be in every county around the country. There are thousands. Whereas prisons are for people who have been sentenced and are serving a definitive amount of time. So, and this work on overdose prevention really is inspired by a number of other sort of studies that have looked at mortality upon release from correctional facilities. The major U.S. study was Dr. Binswanger's study in Washington State, which demonstrated a marked increase in the relative risk for death upon discharge from jail. The overall death rate was significantly higher than the general population overall, but in the first 2 weeks, the risk of death was 12.7 times higher, then would come down. And that increased risk of death was really driven largely by overdose death, though homicide was also a contributing cause. When we looked at this data in the jail system in New York City, we saw a similar trend. So the risk of death in the first 2 weeks following release from the New York City jail system was about 3.8 times that of the general population. And homicide was also a contributor to death, though drugs were greater. So Rikers Island is it's a jail system, so it's a collection of many different jails. There are actually 12 facilities overall. 9 of them are on Rikers Island. 3 are in the boroughs, so in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and there is a barge that floats off of the off of Hunts Point in the Bronx, which is one of the jails as well. There's one women's facility, and there's one adolescent facility, and one facility for people who are sentenced to less than 1 year in jail. The average daily population is around 10,000 currently, which is down from its max in the late 90s of around 22 to 24,000 a day. The annual admissions are 60,000. Length of stay is generally very short, so the mean length of stay is 37 days. Because many people stay a long period of time, the median is significantly shorter than the mean. So the median length of stay, most people leave in the first 7 to 10 days in the jail system. We have an electronic health record, which also allows us to look sort of systematically at our jail system, though it's less of a component of this presentation. I'll just breeze past the demographics. Generally a younger population, but like other correctional settings, overall it is aging. We have about 10% of people who are over the age of 50, 90% male, and majority non-Hispanic, Black, and Hispanic. Mental health and substance use and abuse are prevalent in the jail system. About 38% of people in the jails carry a mental health diagnosis. About 43% self-report drug use at admission, with around 13% reporting heroin and 15% reporting cocaine or crack. There are a few jail-based drug treatment programs in the New York City jails. One is A Road Not Taken, which is a harm reduction and education program that depends partly on self-referrals within the jail system, but also on court referrals as well. So people can be sort of asked to complete this program as a requirement for early release. It is a abstinence program-based program, though we're working to integrate it with other medication-assisted treatment programs in the system. The largest of those, the main MAT program is the KEEP program. This is, as I mentioned before, has been a licensed opioid treatment program since 1987. There's methadone maintenance for the community. There are about 250 maintained at any given moment. And overall, there are about 1,000 detox orders. There's no OTP in the state system, so that means that people who are discharged from the who are arrested and are in the jail system but at risk of entering the state prison system must be detoxed, right? So if we were to maintain them on their community dose and then they got sent up to the state prison, they would not have methadone there and they would go through withdrawal. So that's one of the few places in our jail system that charges actually do come into account, and I should say in the medical care in the jail system. So KEEP counselors do review charges in advance, and if it looks like somebody has a serious felony, then the patient may be detoxed because they're at higher risk to go to the state system. We do also continue buprenorphine treatment in the jail system and have a pilot going right now to provide walking doses of medications to help people get to community-based bup providers. I think probably most people in this room are familiar that naloxone is an opioid antagonist. It reverses the effects of opioids and prevents a fatal overdose from respiratory depression. It can be administered intravenously, intramuscularly, subcutaneously, or intranasally. I'll be talking mostly about intranasal use today. It's a very safe drug. There's no abuse potential, and as mentioned, it has multiple routes of administration. It takes effect within about 2 to 8 minutes and can cause sudden withdrawal symptoms, so it completely blocks the effects of opioids. So somebody moves from being affected by opiates to immediately not having those receptors blocked in their brains. If there's no opiate present, it has minimal effects, which makes it very safe for administration. And it's been routinely used by emergency medical services, sometimes in larger doses, often IV. So I'm going to just briefly touch on some of the aspects of New York State legislation that's allowed us to roll this program out over the years. So one of the first initiatives that came out of New York State was the ability to train lay providers to use naloxone. So that happened in 2006. In 2009, the New York City Department of Health developed opioid reversal kits with intranasal naloxone contained. And these kits were really developed for use in homeless shelters where there had been a number of overdose deaths, and there was nothing on the market really to use, no sort of pre-made kit to use to reverse them. 2010, a Good Samaritan law was signed, which is not specific to naloxone, but it does provide some protections to people who witness an overdose and call 911 to seek help. Potentially protecting them from charges or being found to have drugs on them. In 2014, standing order legislation was signed, which allowed OTPs to have trained lay trainers who distributed naloxone, and I'll mention that in a minute. So this is the kit the New York City Department of Health uses. It contains two doses of naloxone, two atomizers, which allow the naloxone to spread intranasally. There's a blue bag, some personal protective equipment as well. So this is the certificate of completion. So when somebody is trained to administer naloxone as a lay person, they get one of these kits, and they also get the blue card with their name on it and signed by the overdose prevention program, stating that it's legal for them to have this medication in their property. When it's all assembled, this is the naloxone overdose kit. It has the intranasal atomizer. And one thing I guess I'll point out right now, even though it's intranasal, there's a very small needle right in the middle of the kit, which is a challenge in correctional settings. So the program that we started is the Central Visitor Center pilot, also called the Visit House pilot. The Visit House is the sort of lay term on Rikers about for the location that visitors go through when they're coming to see family members. I'll just briefly say that we did think very hard about whether we could provide it directly to inmates, but unfortunately there were a number of jail-specific considerations. One of those was that needle, right? So we can't give the kits out in the jail setting because it's considered contraband, and there's some concern that it could be used as a weapon. The other is a couple logistical issues that jail is a short length of stay, that we have a very short length of stay, and it's irregular, so discharges can happen at really almost any given time from a number of different places, including a few different buildings or in the courts or from various other places. So the challenge of getting the kit into the hand of the person who's walking out of jail, even though they're as I mentioned before, very high risk for overdose, logistically getting those kits to those people is very hard. And there is actually some overdose prevention training that already happens in the A Road Not Taken program, so people do get those blue cards while they're in jail, and when they go to the community, they can go to places like Lower East Side Harm Reduction or other harm reduction programs that distribute naloxone and display their card and get a overdose prevention kit. So our goal was really to train lay, non-medical providers, visitors to Rikers Island in how to identify and reverse opioid overdose using intranasal naloxone. The logic being, as mentioned, high risk of death in the first 2 weeks, and friends and family are likely to be the people to witness these overdoses. So we had a sense that this was the right population to target. So we started our pilot in April of 2014. The trainings are offered in waiting areas as visitors await buses to go to individual jails on Rikers Island. So these are the 9 main jails on Rikers Island. They're basically large waiting areas, almost like when we wait for the transportation from the hotel for this conference. People are sitting and waiting, and it's a good opportunity to provide a 3 to 5 minute training. Basically, trained overdose prevention trainers provide this very short intervention. Once people have they can do a hands-on trial if they want with some sort of practice kits, and once they feel comfortable with the training, they get given one blue card and a handout with resources in the community. And then they go on to go to their visit, so they go to the individual jails on the bus. When they return, they come through the same place, so then our staff set up to distribute the kits to people who have the blue card. And this work was really aided by standing order legislation, which meant that I didn't have to sit out there and write individual prescriptions or a PA or somebody. It meant it really freed up the program to get a larger amount of kits out quicker. We could have more days that we covered. We could cover do one-off trainings and things like that. So, And then based on the pilot experience, we continued the program in 2014. So I'll just quickly orient us. This is the bridge that goes to Rikers Island. It connects Rikers Island with Queens. East Elmhurst, Queens is right over here. LaGuardia Airport is right over here. And City Field as well as nearby. Brooklyn, Manhattan, and the Bronx jails are here as well. But you can see the island's very sprawling. When you come over the bridge to Rikers Island, this is the visitor center. There's a city bus that drops visitors off right here. And then they go through security in the visitor center. When they come out, they take the bus again. So when we do the trainings, visitors come off the bus and then they're waiting over here. This is where we get them and can do group trainings. When they're coming back, we set up over here with the blue kits, and people show us their blue card and get a overdose prevention kit. We've had a lot of interest. You know, we see a really wide range. We see people who are already familiar with overdose prevention and maybe already have a blue card who just want a refresher or want to get a new kit. But we also see grandmothers who know that they have family members who are dependent on opioids and want to get this training. So since June of 2014, we've had about 2,766 visitors trained. We've gotten 2,300 kits into their hands. So I should just mention that this process is not perfect. So sometimes there's a city bus waiting right here and people want to just run and get on the bus and don't want to pick up their kits. Or we have trouble matching up a person who was trained with when they come out of the system. So we don't have perfect overlap between the number of people trained and the number of people who receive kits, but we did get a good proportion, about 2,300 kits out. On average, we do about 10 to 30 trainings per distribution day, so we can have one or two trainers out there. And it's mostly during the warm months because this is mostly outdoor work as well. Sort of anecdotal reports, we've received 14 reports of reversals, but we're doing a more formal study. So I'll just mention, as mentioned before, the challenges have been really engaging visitors when they're waiting, just making sure that we can get people interested and connecting with them upon exit. If the blue card is lost or if the weather's bad, it may impact our distribution efforts. There is some data that shows that about 20% of the kits are going to areas of high needs where overdose rates are significantly higher in the city. Maybe not as high as we would expect, but that's largely a lot of the overdose epidemic in New York City is focused in Staten Island and driven by opioid prescription. So they may not overlap perfectly with the people who are opioid dependent in the jail system. So a formal program evaluation started in August 2015 with the goal of identifying how often the kits are used and what context. It's longitudinal. We enrolled about 289 people. The follow-up is ongoing, but after 1 month, they reached the 1 month follow-up. We received about 232 responses by phone and 125 responses by text message, and had 19 reports of people using the overdose prevention kits in just the first month. So that's about a little around 7%. So we're awaiting the follow-up at 3 and 6 months, but we think it's likely to be very effective. And that's us at the Visit House. Thank you, everyone. So just want to mention, this is work that was done largely under the Department of Health. We recently transitioned to Health and Hospitals Corporation, but we had tremendous support from the Bureau of Alcohol, Drug Use Prevention, Care, and Treatment at DOH, as well as Hillary Cunningham and other partners in the community. Thanks.